Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And I could just go on and on about all of these problems. And what we're doing, folks, as a matter of fact, we've really started out the year, and this is we're doing the curriculum in a chronological order, which means that the only time we're really going to break from the chronological order, because there's one event that happens during the year that we want to recognize, because that's what it's all about. It's all about the Constitution. This is all about the Constitution. Now, there are many myopic organizations out there, and there are many groups that are trying to get you to support your gun rights, because they're going to take your guns. And if they take your guns, then, you know, it's all over. And yet, the whole time, you've been contributing to the Second Amendment rights and keeping your guns. They've been able to indoctrinate your kids to basically go into sexual dysphoria. Their kids are seeking to reassign their genders. They've been teaching DEI, and you've lost your children, but you still have your guns. Yay! You see the irony here, folks. Every time a myopic group gets you to focus on one little fraction of the Constitution, they have convinced you to turn your back on the rest of the Constitution. Now, hold on here. The education system, what's that got to do with our constitutional problem? There is no authority for the federal government to be involved in our education system. They have no authority to be involved and technically, you're not going to like this, and the gun owners are really going to be upset, is that the states do have a right to establish, operate, and regulate the militia if they are regulating the militia. But because of the 1903 Dick Act, where the federal government unconstitutionally seized the control, then the states have basically abdicated their responsibility of maintaining and disciplining and keeping this militia. Technically, folks, the militia is whatever the age group is from 17. It starts at 17 because Congress sets the standards, and it goes to whatever, 60, 55, 50, whatever that age group is, all people capable of serving. In other words, men, women, boys, girls from 17 to whatever that top age is. If you don't have physical disabilities, that means that you must be ready, willing, as a U.S. citizen, and able to take up arms at any minute to go and defend the Constitution and support and defend the Constitution using deadly force. In other words, picking up weapons. Now, if you're a conscientious objector, that doesn't mean you won't have to pick up a weapon to defend yourself if you choose to do so, and you can be slinging hash in the kitchen because they need cooks. They need, people to scrub toilets. I mean, you will be able to serve even if you're a conscientious objector, because it's not just about being an infantryman going and killing and everybody takes care of themselves. We have advanced so far in the technicalities of weaponry, communications, and so forth, that there are plenty of duties that are required that don't necessarily put you behind, put you in a foxhole or in a trench pointing a gun and killing people. So if you're a conscientious objector, that doesn't play anymore as far as whether you have to serve or not. You just won't serve by killing people. Art Carney was a conscientious objector in World War II, and he was a corpsman. So he didn't have to go kill people, but the enemy was firing at his butt, and his job was to save those guys that were being killed or fired at. So anyway, the whole point I'm bringing this up is that if the states actually had a well-regulated militia, then they would actually be in full control over the citizenry. And that goes all the way down. Technically, the full control would be down at the county level. So you may find at county levels that if you are no longer in service of the militia, the need for you to own and carry arms, and as a matter of fact, they could create conditions to say, because of your mental capability, because of your, you know, physical capabilities, you can't bear arms. I mean, there are people that get kicked out of the military because of that. And should they be able to carry arms? The Second Amendment right talks about a well-regulated militia being necessary. So the right of the people. So they can actually go down, and I'm not advocating, but I'm just saying that does everybody absolutely need to if we're really living the militia system? Because if we're living the militia system, that means we don't have police forces anymore. We, the people, carry and execute the law from the county to the state to the federal. We are the ones that enforce everything. And you know what? When you're a law-abiding society, you don't have to worry about crime. And when you're a law-abiding society, the only thing you have to worry about is maintaining your skills, maintaining your capabilities of performing your job. In other words, you know, it's almost like you're going to be a Marine for the rest of your life, or at least till you're in a ripe age, because if you get fat and out of shape, you know, while you're still in that service criteria, then they could actually probably put you on active service, put you on a diet and so forth to make sure you maintain your war fighting capability. Does that make sense, Tammy? And welcome back, Tammy. And we've got maybe a delay. I don't know. I think Tammy's there. She's not muted. So what do you think, Tammy? And Tammy? Hello. Earth to Tammy. So for some reason, folks, and I have no idea, I'll let Tammy try to figure out what's going on with her sound. But I would like to get her input on, you know, me reaching out there on the Second Amendment, because I know this really, you know, just kind of peeves people, because, you know, that's, and here's the interesting thing, and it sounds like you might have your sound back, because I can hear you in the background. I can hear some sound in the background. So here's an interesting thing. We've lost our rights, because the framers considered one of the most sacred things the right of trial by jury. And we have lost our right of trial by jury. But we're still maintaining, and I don't want to call it ridiculous, but we're still maintaining because of all these efforts. Now, they've been chipping away at our Second Amendment rights, or I should say, at our constitutional rights of carry. They've been chipping away at that. So, bottom line, as I lay it out here, why is it, because again, we've turned our back on our right of a trial by jury, where we can absolutely get justice. So the Second Amendment rights folks don't even care about justice. They don't care about whether you get justice or not, as long as they can carry a gun. And if you ask me, that right there is just another form of tragedy where, you know, we become so myopically focused. In other words, the real problem that we have, folks, because if I look at how many people voted for Trump. Look at how many people voted for, basically, and I'll call it the rule of law. Why is it that we do not have full compliance to the Constitution? We do not have full compliance to the Constitution because we have been divided by all of these myopic groups to say we've got to focus on this. And they are the biggest part of our problem. We keep following our passions and thinking, yeah, this right to bear arms is tantamount. And technically, the right to bear arms prior to the Constitution and after the Constitution, there were states in the Union that actually infringed upon their citizens' rights. And the states will still do that until we actually, you know, galvanize that every person should have a 9mm shotgun, what have you. Until we actually require that. But that's what the states need to do. But the states actually, because they're, and the counties are literally ground zero. The counties should actually be driving what that requirement is. Now, everybody that's scared of creating a constitutional amendment, think of it this way. Because your constitution is in a democracy, or I should say it's based on democracy, you point to me, because I think that you can only point to three states that does not use a democratic form of amending the Constitution. What do I mean by that? Mob rule. What do I mean by mob rule? That means 50% plus one vote will actually allow the change of your Constitution. How is that Republican informed? That is not. That's a democratic process changing. In other words, we're allowing mob rule to fundamentally change the supreme law of your state. Therefore, we're in, I'll just call it jeopardy. You stand in jeopardy for your state constitution to be modified by people that would actually go and create a constitutional amendment to take away your right to bear arms or take away your parental rights, those types of things. And technically, the Ninth Amendment should be protecting us from that. And the 14th Amendment in play would not allow the Ninth Amendment, in other words, enumerations in the Constitution cannot be construed to violate these other rights that were retained by the people. Therefore, it would be a real problem. But you want security? You're going to have to change your state constitution. And then when you look at even a blue state, not even a blue state, if you require two-thirds, if not three-fourths of the counties to ratify an amendment to your constitution, your state constitution would never be tossed to and fro by mob rule ever again. In other words, if New York State actually had a constitution where it had this supermajority, or Washington State, had they had a supermajority, in other words, two-thirds of the counties or three-fourths, to change the state constitution, these two states would not have amendments to allow abortion. So when you really look at the real problem, we are the problem because we've been set up and we have no idea the problems that we need to fix until we actually put them on the table. But my point is that even with the Second Amendment, you're going to find that cities will want to ban, you know, everybody's rights in that county to bear arms. But as long as you have a reciprocity clause in your state, that means you have a right for constitutional carry, you can actually go into the county of New York or Chicago, or I think it's Cook's County, whatever those counties are, you can go into that county constitutionally carrying. They cannot deny you that right. They're only denying their citizens. And ergo, this actually starts pushing pressure and so forth. But quit worrying about these stupid little myopic issues. Let's actually start using the Constitution to protect us. There are going to be large groups of people that want to throw themselves into the flames. It's called the, what is, are you back with us, Tammy? I heard a little bing.
I am. Yeah, I don't know what was going on. You should have been able to hear me, but
okay. Yeah, I could not hear you. All of a sudden, you muted yourself, and you did such a doggone good job. Congratulations. So back.
Well, I was unmuted, but
I understand. You weren't coming through. So
yeah.
Okay. So here's the question that I laid out there. You know, I know that with people in Wyoming and really dark red states, I crossed the line and I became a heretic. How dare I say that the states should and could be able to, you know, start drawing lines. Like, if you're a criminal, should you be able to be denied your constitutional right to carry? Well, yeah, actually, that's exactly what happened. When you violated a felony, you committed a felony and were convicted, you couldn't even vote. You lost constitutional rights.
Yeah.
If you are examined, and what we need to do, because we need to protect people from being able to be, oh, this person's crazy, and thrown into, you know, an asylum, what have you. So we need to make sure that there is a very good, rigid process to guarantee that a person, you know, on their own, without any medication, so doing blood tests and everything else, because, you know, you can easily fabricate a condition to make somebody insane or seem insane. So I'm just saying that I have no problem with the state saying this person does not have the mental capacity to be able to carry a gun. There are people, and I know people personally, that are basically children. They're adults, they're 30s, 50s, but their mental capacity cannot exceed or comprehension beyond a 12-year-old. Should we allow people like that to have access to being an adult? No. They shouldn't have a driver's license. So those things. So in other words, the right of the people to bear arms is should not be so absolute. But the problem is that this is an unbending problem. And the real problem is that the Second Amendment rights people aren't actually demanding the restoration of the militia and the implementation of the militia throughout the states down to the counties, getting rid of the mercenary police force. See, this is what they're not doing. They only care about keeping guns. They don't care about the rest of the Constitution, even that part of the Second Amendment. Because if they were, then they would actually prove to everybody that we all have this responsibility. We need to start teaching kids firearm safety at probably age 12 and have them prepared by age 17 to be able to be competent in serving in the militia. In other words, without very little training other than some military occupational specialty type of stuff. Okay, you're going to be this and 4 weeks of training there. Now you're ready to go fight. Because every child should actually be prepared before they turn 17. If we have to go to war, we shouldn't have to go back and train all of these kids that graduated from, you know, from 1960 or whatever, just because they're in the age and they were never trained. This is an abomination to the concept of a self-governing, self-defending system. My point is the Second Amendment folks don't even go down that road. It's all about the keeping of the guns, and they're letting the government get away with all of the other things. And that's why, you know, the shock value. Yay, you got your rights, but we've thrown our kids, you know, into the abyss or into the arms of Satan. How dare these folks do this? And, you know, because they're so hypocritical, they're easy to pick on. And because they're so popular, I know I'm really scoring points with a lot of listeners. Because, folks, we got to start recognizing these paradoxes. We got to start calling people out for being hypocrites. Any organization, whether it's the, you know, Moms Medical Freedom, Mom Stuff, and hey, go fund this, and it's all about the kids. If these organizations, and this is the litmus test, if the John Birch Society, if the Gun Owners Association, if the Moms Medical Freedom, blah, 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 if these organizations are not putting aside their differences and working and managing all First Amendment petitions for all issues of restoring our constitutional rights and working together, becoming a leader in the county and the state of saying, yeah, you need to be joining us. We all need to be standing up. If we all united on the principle that we all have to stand up, this conflict would be over that fast. Because look at how many people wanted liberty or the rule of law. We just have to demand the rule of law. Because the Trump election, and I believe many Democrats want the rule of law as well. It's just that they're caught up in the partisan, I'm not going to ever vote for Trump. I hate Trump. Whatever those things are, folks, I still believe that the majority of Americans have not crossed that threshold. They may not believe in God anymore. So, you know, those people that are all hung up on, you know, their First Amendment right of religious expression, you know, put aside your differences. The litmus test must be this. If they're not actively supporting all First Amendment petitions in restoring and making them better, getting involved in our right of petition and demanding the redress of grievances with our representatives. That is the process. This is a Republican form of government. It is not a judiciary form of government. It is not about going into court. And every organization that says we got to go to court over this is misleading you. Because your representatives have the power of creating law and nullifying law. The court has no power to create law and has no power to nullify law. It is not in the Constitution. The only other branch...
Sorry, I have a question.
Go ahead. Yes. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm preaching, so forgive me.
So currently, you know, in Wyoming, they passed the Right to Life Act, and then that got challenged in the court, of course. It was taken to the judiciary level, and then... the Supreme Court of Wyoming deemed that abortion is a health care issue. So everybody has a right to abortion.
So actually, Everybody may have a right to abortion, but no institution, no doctor can be inflicted or forced to actually pay for it, and the taxpayers can't pay for it. But actually, if you want to create an amendment, or if the counties want to say, we make it illegal for an abortion to be performed in our county, you got to go somewhere else. We're not going to make it a crime that you go somewhere else, but we're not going to allow the death of a baby in this, the boundaries of this government.
Okay, so that's what the state did.
So
the state passed the law.
Okay, so here's the problem with the courts. The court, the state passed a law, and the court pulled the law in. Show me in the Constitution where the court has that kind of positive power over the legislature. They don't. So what has to happen is the law gets implemented, the state passes this law, then somebody needs to actually try to go get an abortion and say, hey, I can't get an abortion, and try to sue on the premises of why they can't get an abortion and how this law is unjust. Then the case has to review that, and then in that particular case, the court can actually say, well, we believe you should have an abortion, you can get an abortion, yay, verily, go get an abortion. But that doesn't mean that the state, one, has to pay for it. It just means that that person can go get an abortion, that they're going to have to find a place to do it. Because if the state's law is that no institution and no public money will be used to terminating a life, period, it would be up to, the individual to, figure out how to go terminate. Now, we're not talking about saving the life of a mother. We're talking about literally just killing a child because the child is unwanted by the mother, not by the father, but by the mother. Now, if we want to, be real, justice heroes, I think that both parents should have to sign off on, the termination period, because it takes two to make that child, because, it seems like after the child is born, that father's on the hook for everything. Why isn't he on the hook before that? There's the hypocrisy there, but bottom line, government cannot tax you to do something like that unless it is absolutely within their authority and power. If the people have never granted them the authority, they don't even have to create a law. They just defund it and say, we're not paying for abortions, period. You have an unwanted pregnancy, you deal with it. And you're going to have to go out of this state because we're not going to pay for it. And because everybody's got socialized medicine in Wyoming, practically, it's not coming out of that medical care. If you're paying for your own medical care, the insurance company's going to pay for it. Now your problem is who's going to perform it.
Okay, so are you saying that the state has the right to make the law against abortion, and that
No, I'm saying
to overrule that.
I am saying that the state, if there is no enumeration in the state constitution to be involved in making that type of decision, which it's not in there, then they can't even really make the law against abortion. Their job is to make sure that they're only funding those things that are actually enumerated within the Constitution. You're going to find out that they shouldn't even be funding for health care, because that's a federal mandate that's come down that is unconstitutional. They shouldn't be funding the environment agencies. They shouldn't be funding, and paying for these, energy regulations. There's many things that the state has, tripped over and has started creating laws because they're told that they have to do this by the federal government. We're running out of time. We're going to go into a break. So you gather your thoughts, and when we come back, we can kind of revisit all of this, because this way, I think we can actually kind of start seeing that there are constitutional constraints on law. You cannot create a law if you have not been delegated the power to create that law. And so the fact that they created a law, it must be an amendment to the Constitution. There must be an amendment that says abortion shall not occur in this state. I'm Jerry Mobley. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now that we've kind of gathered our thoughts, I'm hoping this starts to make sense. The federal government tried to create the ability to tax the people and actually go out and improve highways, waterways, by creating bills of action to go and build this road, to go and improve this waterway, to go and do these things. In other words, giving themselves the power to basically create the foundation of the Department of Transportation. Well, they can't do that because that power's not been enumerated and granted to them. They do not have that delegated grant. Because everything that they do, like an act to create a uniform rule of naturalization, they actually have that delegation in the Constitution where they can actually create the uniform rule of naturalization to apply to every state that brings new citizens into the United States. See, the United States, it's not their job to swear people in. It is the state's job. They only make a uniform rule of naturalization, which means that the states are responsible for ensuring that the people are all being taught the history necessary, that they speak English, that they're aware of our laws, and they're going to abide by the laws, and then they take this oath that abjures their allegiance. This is why if you're Islamic and you claim to be a citizen because you've been sworn in, but you actually say, I don't have to support and defend the Constitution. In other words, you're in direct defiance of that legal oath that you've taken. Then you should be stripped of your citizenship, period. And as a matter of fact, I mean, I can't understand how we're even allowing people that have a religious obligation not to support the Constitution. In other words, this culture, this Islamic culture, is not even congruent or harmonious with our fundamental rules of law and our principles of liberty. They believe in subjugating us. They believe in forcing us into Islam, and that's exactly what they're going to do because that's what their good books tell them, or their evil books, however you want to look at it. They believe that they're doing the right thing based on their God and based on their beliefs. But anyway, back to this abortion thing. Does the Wyoming state constitution grant the state legislature to create a law or regulate abortion or regulate life, such as births and terminations of births?
Well, I can tell you they used Article 1, Section 38. C of the Wyoming Constitution, which is the provision that says that it allows the legislature to set reasonable and necessary restrictions on the health care decision, right, to protect the health and general welfare of the people. So I think that's what they used to say that they had the constitutional authority to create an abortion law.
Okay, so you're saying Article what? Section what?
Article 1, Section 38C.
38C, the legislature may determine reasonable and necessary restrictions on the rights granted under this section to, in other words, the entire right of health care access. So, in other words, under this section. So you got to start with Section A, B, C, and then D, right? So Each competent adult shall have the right to make his or own her health care decisions. The parent, guardian, or legal representative of any other natural person, in other words, if you're under the age of 18, that means that the parent has to make the decision, period, right? Because that's what they're laying that out. Okay, so B, any person may pay, and a health care provider may accept direct payment or health care without imposition of penalties or fines for doing so. So in other words, any person can pay for the procedure or have the insurance pay for the procedure. But it doesn't mean that they have the right to actually tax the people to pay for any procedure. As a matter of fact, you'll find that when you go through here, the state's responsibility is to ensure the individual freedom exists to make their own decisions on their own health. In other words, it's a very libertarian. These are libertarian principles. C, the legislature may determine reasonable and necessary restrictions on the rights granted under this section to protect the health and general welfare of the people or to accomplish the other purposes set forth in the Wyoming Constitution. There's nowhere here where they say that we can actually impose these types of restrictions other than the right of pain. Would they have to pay? Yeah, of course they're going to have to pay. Would they do the parents? Because they're talking about making restrictions under these sections. Section 1 talks about who's going to make the decision. It's got to be an adult. If it's a child wanting to terminate a child, then the parent has to make the decision. Can they make a restriction to ensure that? Yeah, so in other words, they can create a law that requires positive identification and age for any person when they come in to verify that that is a competent adult that's going to make a decision on healthcare.
Now you have the problem that the Wyoming Supreme Court has said that abortion is healthcare.
It is not.
So now does that mean that Medicaid has to pay for abortions?
No.
And that insurance has to pay for abortions?
Okay, so Medicaid is not constitutional, right? So show me, where does Medicaid come from? It comes from the federal government and the states. In other words, the federal government basically says, we're going to tax you for something we have no authority to tax you for. And now we're going to create a regulation that the states have to equally tax so that they can participate in this program of receiving the money we're taxing for. In other words, it's a scam. It's like a Ponzi scheme. Bottom line, whether there's Medicaid strings, any regulation that's coming from Medicaid, Medicare, and or federal regulations that are not within and are not derivatives of the enumerated objects within the Constitution are unconstitutional. We know this. The federal government cannot do these things. And yet they get away with doing it, saying, we're going to give you money, and you got to abide by these stipulations. Well, first off, the state shouldn't be taking the money. And second off, I mean, I understand what would end up happening. Wyoming, the spigot of federal funding coming into Wyoming would stop. But let's look at the reality. How much money is Wyoming having to dig out of its own pockets because of these strings? That it is so oppressive that they're actually raising the taxes on the people to a point that the people are just going, we can't do this. You're actually heading into a financial crisis because the people are getting tax relief on their property. And the state legislature, because they're playing these games by actually receiving and following the strings attached to unconstitutional money, now they still have to come up with the money to basically meet those obligations coming with those strings, because they want free money. And all the while that they're doing this, they're not unleashing their resources. And all the while, they're not, basically taking advantage of their rights of commerce. And what I'm saying is the energy sector could be opened up in Wyoming just like that, because the energy regulations in Wyoming are unconstitutional. All the federal regulations and any state regulation regarding energy is unconstitutional. It's not in the state constitution nor in the federal constitution for them to be able to regulate this commerce. Okay, go create an amendment if you want to do that. But until you do, the state actually has the ability to create a boon in its economy and start hiring big time people of the state of Wyoming. And as a matter of fact, they need to probably look at creating an amendment that would protect Wyoming from outside labor and outside moves. In other words, if a person comes there into the state of Wyoming, they're not going to be eligible to just take a job, an empty seat in a job. You know, in other words, make it so that they have to live there 6 months, a year, or what have you, before they can start working for an energy company. Forcing the energy company to ensure that the kids and the people of Wyoming are getting educated so that they're capable of coming in and doing the job. Forcing, you know, Wyoming to really become I hate to use the word sustainability, but these ideas of, you know, creating a government that actually meets the needs of the people that they're serving is like, it's stating the obvious. And yet they don't think of these things. But when you look at the resources that Wyoming has in minerals, energy, and so forth, they could actually be creating a boom. And as a matter of fact, the majority of the people would start moving to where that coal is. The majority of the people would start moving where the jobs are. And these would be good paying jobs. But my point is, this unleashes the economy of Wyoming so the people will actually be paying for themselves instead of having their hands out. Do you want to be the slaves of the federal government while they continually manipulate you and actually force these immoral laws and these immoral paradigms upon you, or free yourself and say, you know what, we're our own agents? And bottom line, in the state of Wyoming, they can't make a law regarding energy nor abortion because it's not delegated to them. Nor do I see in Section 38 the ability to say you have a right. There's nowhere where I see anywhere in the state constitution where they've granted the right of abortion. And so what has happened is the state court is starting to create law and trying to basically subvert the state constitution by using their own agenda. And so what should happen is the justices that are making those types of rulings and actually trying to create law, because I'll bet you anything, there's nowhere in the Wyoming state constitution that allows a justice to create law. They think that when they create a verdict, it becomes law. No, when they create a verdict on, you know, let's say Podunk v., you know, Wyoming, you know, this town that wants, you know, everybody in this town is all immoral, like, you know, maybe Casper. And I know I hate to throw people under the bus because I know there's good people in Casper. But bottom line, Podunk v. Wyoming, they demand that, you know, they have every doctor in that town performing abortions and performing, you know, sexual, you know, gender reassignments, all these types of things. And we want you to do these things. Well, hold on here. You know, if the state court decides that that's constitutional, the state court has to actually say, this is where you can find it by citing it in the state constitution. If they just declare that we determine that is a constitutional thing, and therefore they're trying to change the constitution, then those justices need to be removed. But let's just say in the case, let's just say in the case that the justices actually make a proper ruling. In other words, and I'll give you a case like Maryland v. McCullough, that the Podunk, the town of Podunk v. Wyoming, this case is about the town, because you may have a state office, you may have a state building resources where, you know, you have all, you know, all your snow clearing vehicles, the snow clearing sand, salt, and all these things you apply on the road to keep the, and they say, you know what, that's property, we want to tax that property. And so we're going to levy a property tax upon the state. You can't do that. And as a matter of fact, that is just fundamentally, you can't tax a function that is within, and technically, I'm using a bad example because I believe by the state constitution, they don't even have the authority to be doing the road clearing and all of that. That's all being pushed down from the federal government as well. Because, so folks, when you start looking at these constitutions, you're going to realize that these powers don't exist. But let's just say there is a power there. There is a power, like maybe hunting. And so let's say they have a building and they want to tax the building of a legitimate service that the state is providing. You cannot put property tax on those legitimate services and buildings and property, period. So therefore, that ruling would stand as a legitimate ruling. It doesn't create law, and it's not applicable to anything else. In other words, in another town down the road where, you know, they have a different spin on it, and again, let's just say it is for fish licensing and hunting. Okay, so they try to tax something that is actually legitimate. And then all of a sudden, another town down the road goes, wow, we have this huge, you know, area that is a road clearing for the highways, adjoining, you know, state highways and so forth. And this is acres and acres of salt and plows and all of these things. We're going to tax this because it's not within the Constitution. And ergo, the court should actually say this taxation is legitimate because that property is not legitimate. That actually the state should not be in this function because they don't have the authority to possess that land for these purposes. Therefore, the taxation, they have to rule that the taxation is legitimate. However, the state has to, because they can't tell the state to not do something. They don't have the power to create or nullify law. So they basically have to say, state, you're operating outside the boundaries, and we advise you to either amend the Constitution to have the authority to do this service or stop providing the service. That's all. It's an advisory.
That's what the Supreme Court should have said with the abortion.
They kind of did say that in the overturning of the Roe v. Wade. What they said was, we should never have been involved in this, and therefore we're remanding this back to the states. Okay, so they kind of said that, but what they didn't say, and I think this is what you mean, is they actually should have said, any dollars that are being used, any tax dollars that are being used, this would be an advisement to the federal government. This would actually be in the opinion that anything and everything that the federal government is doing now moving forward, because this is not an enumeration in the Constitution, they're literally defrauding the people. They don't want to say that. And that's why the language was in the Roe v. Wade to say, you know, don't construe that even though this isn't in the Constitution, because there's other things that we're doing that may not be the same. We're just applying this proper constitutional context to this, and we're not going to allow you to create the constitutional context to these other things that we don't have the authority to do. They kind of put that little block in there to say, we're only recognizing this one thing, even though there may be others. Interesting. They actually covered, it's kind of like, you know, when you got this person, a guy out there playing a pretty aggressive athletic sports, and you realize that he's covering something up because he doesn't have the right protection. And so anyway, because that's exactly what they're doing. They don't have the right protection, so they're covering something up, but they wanted to make sure that nobody really recognized why they were covering, you know, that this was a cover-up. And that overturning of Roe v. Wade was one trying to get something right on the moral issue, even though it wasn't about morality. It was about this was not enumerated. See, the courts don't care about the Constitution. I believe that there's probably one or two members like Clarence Thomas. I think Anthony Scalia. But I still don't believe that these guys really fathomed just how bad and how far it went. Or these guys would have been screaming and saying, as the, you know, the mad voice of reason, you know, talking out and against the bench, because they would have been far more. I think the hyperbole, or I should say the rancor and the venom coming from these rogue, or I should say constitutional justices, would have been far more enlightening and been, you know, far more educational, where the people of America would have started realizing just how far the courts have gone outside the bounds of the Constitution, as well as the federal government. They've both been enabling each other to assume and assume and assume all sorts of authorities, powers, and so forth, and roles, responsibilities, properties, all sorts of violations, direct, indirect, against the Constitution to create this this insane level of tyranny that we are living under. And so with that, maybe we can get started on, and I, you know, I'm going to do this real quick, folks, because yesterday we kind of closed on, or actually it wasn't yesterday, it was last week, our previous show. We closed on the Annapolis Convention. So in other words, the Annapolis Convention closed, we concluded on that, and then we read the proceedings from Congress that the Continental Congress sent a message out, even though it wasn't really asked. It was requested by a few states that they actually piped in to give it more emphasis so that every state would show up. So New York, and I think there was another state, there are two states that said, please, please endorse and demand that the states actually attend the convention in May of 1787, the following year. So they did. And so as we look at the what happened after the Annapolis Convention, because, folks, we actually have this. This is on the academic source documents page. And I'm going to go through there and clean it up into the sequence that we've been following, so it'll be more chronological. But there's a document called the Combined State Acts authorizing the election of delegates for the 1787 Constitutional Convention. Now, you're going to find that as we go through this, that there, each state will have done this at different dates and times. And so what I want to do is I want to find the first state that did this. January so far is the soonest. Aha, right here. So New Jersey kind of led the pack so far, because 24 November, before Continental Congress even piped in and endorsed this, New Jersey had called for their delegates and appointed them to attend. So when we go through these things, you're going to see exactly what everybody, Pennsylvania did it in December, so that was prior to as well. South Carolina, March, so Virginia, November. So Virginia leaned forward to the 23rd of November, and so New Jersey was the second, and then the next one, I think, was Pennsylvania. So now you can see how some of the states were so adamant about the need for this convention that they already created their delegates. Now, here's the interesting thing. Virginia was the first. But guess what? George Washington was not on board. Now, I'm bringing this up because in a previous show or two, we talked a little bit about the Shay Rebellion. Oh, the Shay Rebellion was the primary reason for the convention. If that's the case, because of the militia and Washington's feelings and sentiments regarding the militia and the ability to suppress insurrections, he would have been on board with it. No, it was literally at that point in time, under the Articles of Confederation and the paradigm that states' problems were states' problems, that they didn't want to have a central government going around to keep states in check. And the Shay's Rebellion, even though it was repugnant and Washington spoke out against it, it wasn't a driving factor to say that's why we need to convene a convention. The driving factor, as we've proven, was literally the ineptitude and the impotency of Continental Congress and the Articles of Confederation. It was completely inept. That was the problem. That's why they had eight amendments by that time. And one little Shay's Rebellion up in Massachusetts. Okay, so I know that there's a lot of people that put their, you know, their emotions into how they think. We have to look at this academically in the primary source documents. If the Shay's Rebellion weighed to that degree, they would have mentioned it, that we're at the brink of literally an uprising, an internal insurrection. That wasn't the case. That was literally the case because Massachusetts needed money and they were not, you know, the people were not willing to pay taxes to the extent of what the state needed. Now, you got to remember, who was it that needed all of the Confederation support because they were literally being leveled and being, they were under the heel of the king for a long time? What state was that? Oh, yeah, shoot, that's right. It was Massachusetts. So the state that needed all of this help and got all this help wasn't willing to pay their share. So the hypocrisy abounds. And so we're just trying to place the context on the paradigm. Because, again, unfortunately, the people at that point in time, the Puritans at that point in time, were very much like John Adams. John Adams was an arrogant, you know, Puritan. I mean, he looked down. Everybody else were heathens. They really believed they were better, unfortunately. And unfortunately, we see that today, whether that be race, whether we see that with gender, it doesn't matter. It gets applied to everything now. But back in those days, it was literally a religious superiority, this paradigm that our culture was better. And in some ways, they had bragging rights. Technically, at that point in time, in the history of the colonies, the average life expectancy in the state of Massachusetts was what, Tammy? Do you know?
I don't.
It was around 70 years of age. It was the highest in the Union, and it was significantly higher than most states. Because
that's pretty good. Yeah, that's pretty good for back then.
Yeah, so they had some bragging rights because they were very well educated, and it was a small state, so they had all these peoples close enough that it was, you know, truly a community state, where Virginia had these little pockets, and they had, you know, people that were very illiterate and way out there, you know, doing, I don't know, moonshine, what have you. But the conditions were very different. But nevertheless, Massachusetts basically caused their problem. Now, when we come back, I wanted to do this transition so that we kind of close this and nip this in the bud. When we come back after we're, you know, because we've got about a minute left, anything else you want to bring up regarding Wyoming or leading into these acts? Because we have all 13 states that literally identified who the delegates were and gave them commissions. Now, some of these states were a little bit late showing to the dance. In other words, they got their dance cards, you know, like in June or July. So they kind of came in and go, well, so what's going on? What are we doing? And they had to do that because at that point in time, the convention went into secrecy. They weren't sharing what they were doing. I think that's one of the reasons why it forced a couple of other states, because they wanted to know. They needed somebody in there to protect them because they had no idea what was going on. And remember, there was a lot of distrust from the small states with these few big states. There were more small states. They go, you know what? We better get in there and help these guys because they may need our help. They may need, you know, us in keeping these big states and these cabals at bay. So with that, I hate to say this, but we're, you know, just seconds away from going into the end of the show. I know I probably offended people. My intent is not necessarily to be a shock value guy or to offend people. The fact of the matter is, when we read something, it's not just the Second Amendment is not just the right to bear arms. It is about the importance and the place and the context of having a well-regulated militia, and ensuring and restoring that is far more important than, you know, just focusing on your guns. I'm Jerry Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.